All right, I think we'll get started here. We've got a lot to talk about, and I want to make sure we have enough time for the questions and answers. My name is Jeff Sutton. I'm a judge on the Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit based in Cincinnati. I live in Columbus, Ohio. You may have noticed the title for our session today is The Policy Implications of the Reaction to Climate Change. That's an extravagantly vague title that will pick up an extravagantly broad range of topics. We've got the Kyoto Protocol, whether it's still relevant or not. We've got the various roles of the states, state agencies, the federal government, federal agencies, the international community in enforcing all of these laws. We've got the role of the courts in refereeing these disputes. And perhaps the real elephant in the room is what can meaningfully be done with the new administration that starts in a couple months. There were a lot of campaign promises by the incoming president, and the question is whether our current economic climate is going to allow much, if any, change in this area, particularly in the with respect to international treaties or protocols. We've got a first-class group of speakers here to walk us through these topics. As is typical with these sessions, we'll have roughly 8 to 10 minute presentations. I'll be yanking on their legs at about 10 minutes to make sure we've got enough time, I hope, for about a half hour's worth of questions and answers. There's a microphone here. There's one there. And I'll arbitrate that once we get to that part of the session. I'm going to introduce our speakers in the order in which they will be speaking. The first is Stephen Hayward, the Weyerhaeuser Fellow in Law and Economics at the American Enterprise Institute. He is the co-author of AEI's Environmental Policy Outlook, the principal author of the Annual Index of Leading Environmental Indicators, and the author of 4 books on politics and the presidency, including, I guess this must be his 5th book, Air Quality in America, which I bet you could get at least 1 signed copy, unless I take it, at the end of the session. Our next speaker will be John Dernbach, distinguished professor of law at Widener University in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. John teaches environmental law, property law, and international law. He co-authored an amicus brief on behalf of 18 climate scientists in the Massachusetts versus EPA U.S. Supreme Court case. He's a 1978 Michigan Law School graduate. John, I went to Ohio State. We've got a big football game this weekend. I'm wearing my scarlet and gray. I hope we'll win. I hope we'll trounce you. Woody Hayes was once asked, there's a famous game, it's like back in the 60s or so, Ohio State was up on Michigan at something like 54-6. There was a minute left. Ohio State scored yet another touchdown, going up now they're up by 55 points or something, and he goes for 2 instead of kicking one extra point. And after the game, the press said to him, how could you possibly go for 2 points in a situation like that? Because I couldn't go for 3. John's also got the state perspective because before teaching, he worked at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Our third speaker will be another Buckeye, Jonathan Adler, professor of law and director of the Center for Business Law and Regulation at Case Western. He's an author or editor of 3 books on environmental law, and I actually thought John Adler was 2 or 3 people, given the number of entries I see under that name on the Vol Conspiracy and the National Review Online. He's quite prolific. He also authored an amicus brief in the Massachusetts versus EPA case. I think it was a little bit different from John's, but they both participated in the same case. And our fourth speaker is Jeremy Rabkin, who teaches international law at George Mason University Law School. Much of his recent scholarship analyzes emerging conflicts between international law and traditional notions of national sovereignty. He serves on the Board of Academic Advisors of the AEI and the Board of Directors of the U.S. Institute of Peace. So with that, Steve, why don't you get us started?
Well, thank you, Judge Sutton. Good afternoon, everyone. I am not a lawyer, and I don't even play one on TV. I'm going to try and set the scene with some old-fashioned policy wonkery. It's considered D Class A, and it's not the subject of our panel this afternoon to be openly skeptical about catastrophic global warming, so I won't do that. But I will do something nearly as bad. I'm going to stick with the nearly equal heresy of disputing that rapid or steep reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are the path of supreme virtue and the primary policy to be pursued, even in the face of prospectively significant climate change. My thesis is that the rigors of what I call environmental correctness and the prolonged and solemn farce of the Kyoto process are generating the greatest mass hypocrisy since perhaps the Kellogg-Briand Pact promised to end warfare in 1928. Or, as I often put it in just the American context, I'm pretty confident that within 10 or 20 years, and it might even be 10 or 20 months, we're going to look back on the Kyoto process as the climate policy equivalent of wage and price controls to fight inflation in the 70s. My corollary is the traditional regulatory tools of environmental policy are not even the right framework for addressing this problem, even in its most severe prospective dimensions. So even as President-elect Obama promises to get with the program that Bush has neglected for the last 8 years, the scene in Europe right now is one of national governments looking for the exits from their grand rhetoric. German Chancellor Angela Merkel last week reiterated the necessity of EU member states agreeing to ambitious targets for the year 2020, but saying at the same time that there must be exemptions for key German industries. 2 days ago, she said, quote, emissions reductions must be taken in such a way as to not weigh on industry, close quote. In other words, circuits have to be costless. One sees the obvious parallel to the long-suffering trade liberalization talks in which European Union nations pay lip service to free trade, even as they increase their own agricultural subsidies and trade barriers. In Australia, the ruling Labor Party, which made fealty to the Kyoto process one of its key campaign promises a year ago, is now splitting badly over their proposed emissions trading program. The new government in New Zealand has ordered a top-to-bottom review of its emissions trading scheme and as a signal that they're either going to scale it back or abandon it entirely. Canada's backing away from its proposed carbon tax. 2 weeks ago, the chair of the California Air Resources Board, Mary Nichols, who I can tell you is no shrinking violet when it comes to extending new regulation, said she was, quote, thinking of punting, close quote, on the details of an emissions trading scheme for California that is supposed to begin operating in the year 2012. And if you go over in Japan, whose economy is more than twice as energy efficient on energy use per a dollar of GDP as the United States, their greenhouse gas emissions have risen 9% since 1990, with a fairly flat economy and virtually no population growth. I can go on in this vein, and I interpret all this as signs of evidence that the air is starting to leak out of the climate change bubble, the successor to the internet bubble and the housing bubble. Even Al Gore is slightly changing his tune if you pay close attention to his article in the New York Times, New York Times the day after the election. Now, all this was utterly predictable. In fact, the template for the unfolding of this issue was laid out 35 years ago in political scientist Anthony Downs' famous article on the issue attention cycle, where he talks about how we get euphoric and excited about a new crisis because the euphoria comes from the opportunity to save the world with transformative action. And then the key step, the third one, is reckoning with the serious costs involved and then declining public interest. We've seen this cycle with the population bomb of the late 60s and early 70s, with the resource exhaustion panics of the 1970s and so forth. This time, I think the Green Crusaders have bit off more than they can chew. And to mix references, they're calling for a transformation of the world's economy so sweeping and unrealistic that it would make King Canute blush. The target that Barack Obama has embraced, and John McCain wasn't that far behind, so I don't want to be picking on him, was that we need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by the year 2050 from the 1990 baseline, which is significant. Well, what does this mean in real terms? I mean, it's easy to throw around percentages, and it's easy to throw around large numbers like 6 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions a year, which is about our level in round numbers in the United States. If you take an 80% reduction from 1990 levels, it means by the year 2050, we have to get down to about 1 billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions. When was the last time the United States had emissions at that level? Well, if you look at Department of Energy historic tables, it turns out we were at that level of emissions at about the year 1910, 100 years ago, when the country had 92 million people and per capita income in current dollars was about $6,000 apiece. In the year 2050, we'll have 420 million people, which means on a per capita basis, we will have to have an emissions profile much lower than our great-grandfathers had in 1910. In fact, to meet the 80 by 50 target, per capita emissions can be no more than 2.5 tons per person. Question, anybody know what nations in the world right now have emissions at that level? Well, it's, you know, garden spots like Haiti, Somalia, Jordan, you know, poor undeveloped countries. It's possible the U.S. never emitted at that low a level, even when we just burned wood and whale oil in our lamps. The lowest industrialized nation's emissions profile right now are France and Switzerland. They're the very best. France, of course, gets 80% of its electricity from nuclear power. It's a small, compact country. People don't drive very far. You don't have to ship goods very far. They emit 6.5 tons per capita right now of CO2. Switzerland is actually a little better. They get almost all their power from nuclear or hydropower, the other form of non-emitting power that our environmentalists don't like. And they emit about 6.2 tons per capita. So even if the U.S. were to match the French and Swiss performance, which given our geography is probably not possible under our current energy system, we'd still be way, way, way above the 2050 target. I'll give you just one more example. If the house, the Energy Department breaks this up by sector. If the household sector in 2050, when we'll have 40 million more households than today, is to stay with its, roughly its same share of emissions that it has today, then the household sector can account for no more than about 205 million tons of CO2. Right now, today, emissions from natural gas use from our household sector, just natural gas in our ovens and our furnaces, 237 million tons. That doesn't count a lot of electricity generated by coal or natural gas or anything. So right now, today, our household sector is, you know, 30-40% above where it has to be. In 40 years, we'll have 40 million more households. Are we really going to retrofit the existing housing stock completely with all electric appliances generated by, what, windmills? Because we can't have coal. That's not going to work. You could replace every single coal-fired power plant with natural gas and still be more than twice as high as the 80 by 50 target. I can go on about this. I've done a, you know, a great deal of analysis on how this all works. Can bore you to death. I'm going to skip over a lot on this. I sometimes ask people at the Department of Energy or the European energy agencies, you know, both our energy department and the International Energy Agency, they have projections of greenhouse gas emissions based on energy use. They all go up like this. And the 80 by 50 target says we're going to go like that. And I ask them, do you sort of look at these targets and sort of close your door and giggle? They say, yeah, that's pretty much what we do. There's these two good energy economists at Princeton, Stephen Sokolow and Pakula. Can't remember their first names exactly right. They have a plan that would hold our emissions flat by the year 2050. You know, a whole lot of things, including a lot of nuclear power plants, which may or may not be feasible and affordable and so forth for lots of reasons. And hard to know what a lot of these new technologies would cost, like concentrated solar, but one estimate is that would be about $6 trillion to stay flat by the year 2050. Now, very quickly, since I'm almost out of time, what are the alternatives? One is we need to have some energy breakthroughs. We've got new energy has to be cheaper than what we have today. If it's more expensive, that's not going to work because developing nations aren't going to buy it. Hard to say that in 20 or 30 years we're not going to see some, so you don't want to be a complete naysayer on that, but that's a tough problem. Second one the IPCC has endorsed, but everyone ignores this, is adaptation. Jonathan Adler's written some good detailed papers on what you would do in the areas of water, for example, in the West. Finally, the one that I think that we're going to move to by force of gravity is what's called geoengineering. To make a long story short, it's built some artificial sunshades. There's been a lot of scientific interest in this. The Royal Academy of Sciences in Britain is launching a big project on it. It's very controversial because it's not environmentally correct. When NASA proposed to hold a workshop on this 2 years ago, they had shouting matches in the hallway. Don't ever let someone say that there's no politics in science, right? Now, the science is actually easier than the politics and the law. One problem with this idea is that, you know, anybody could do it. China could decide in 20 years that they want to put up sulfate emissions in the high altitude to deflect solar radiation. And there may or may not be existing law. Some of the UN treaties on manipulating the environment for hostile purposes and so forth. There's going to need to be some new international law if this idea is to be developed. Russia might well think that it would be a hostile act to cool off the Northern Hemisphere. They're one of the big winners from global warming, right? Canada might feel the same way. So this is a knotty political and legal problem. And I will stop there. 15 seconds over time.
Very good.
So I don't get sanctioned by the judge.
Good afternoon, and thank you all. When I was in fifth grade, I read one of those little books about World War II that were available in the 1950s, early 1960s, and it was about the Seabees. The Seabees were the naval amphibious engineers who provided a lot of the support for the island hopping campaign for the U.S. military as it moved toward Japan in the Pacific during World War II. Their motto was, can do. We need an amphibious bridge built across the 600-yard strait by tomorrow morning. Can you do that, Lieutenant? Yes, sir, can do. And I was thinking, I have in a file folder at home a column from Russell Baker, who wrote in the Milwaukee Journal, at least it was published in the Milwaukee Journal in 1970 or 1971 as the Clean Air Act was being discussed, a column about the Seabees. And he compared, and it's interesting because I've kept this column for years, but suddenly today the column seems very timely. He compared the Seabees with the attitude of the U.S. automakers during the time of the Clean Air Act debate in 1970. And he said that the position that they seemed to be taking was can't do. We can't do this. And if there's a question that I would put before you today, as Americans, confronted with a problem where there's an enormous scientific consensus that if not certainty, there is at least substantial risk of very negative impacts to the United States and the rest of the world, what the position of the United States ought to be going into this issue? Should it be can do or should it be can't do? And I want to sort of walk through analysis in sort of the following ways. There's a couple of points that I want to cover, and I know you'll keep me on time. But I want to go back to the amicus brief that was referred to. We were representing, I was privileged to be part of a legal team that represented these 18 prominent clients, climate scientists. And apart from all the legal stuff, the thing that really impressed me, walking inside the science in great detail for the first time really, was that the scientists themselves are surprised by how fast all of this is unfolding. They said in conference calls and in the brief that the way this was, that they know that from basic atmospheric physics, stuff that nobody would argue about, that if you put more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, that increases pressure for warming in the atmosphere, and that the atmosphere is going to continue to warm and sea levels are going to rise. But they said, and this was so interesting to me, they said they didn't expect to see any of this happen in their lifetime. And the picture they painted was that this is all unfolding very fast. And I think a lot of you have seen the stories, and I won't repeat those. Now, how does that all work? This is not an environmental issue, or just an environmental issue. This is a sustainable development issue. And what I mean by that, I'll go back to the Earth Summit in 1992, when the nations of the world, including the United States, under the presidency of George the First, President Bush, signed on to some non-binding agreements to achieve sustainable development. Now, what does that mean? Well, what sustainable development is about is it takes the environment and economic development and social well-being and security and says, let's make all of those work together. For most of my life, we've treated the environment as the price of progress in all these other dimensions, social, economic, and security. But what sustainable development is all about is it says we've got to put all of those together, and we've got to make them all work together. And we've got to make them all work together for human quality of life, human freedom, and human opportunity, the same endpoints as the traditional development model. Now, what that means in real-world terms now is that people all over the world are experiencing problems because of climate change. And the overwhelming number of those people and the most severest impacts are being felt in developing countries. Whether it's droughts or challenges with water supplies, the science is actually, there's a lot of it. And what is happening actually all around the world, the most recent reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change really weren't about the models anymore. They're all about observed effects. The debate has really changed a lot in that regard. Now, I know, because I sat in on the panel on religious freedom, how much the moral and ethical piece of your lives means to the members of the society. And what I would assert to you in no uncertain terms, with 100% level of confidence, that this is not just a policy wonk issue, and it's not just a legal issue, it's a moral issue, and it's an ethical issue. And it's an issue that is about when 25% of historic greenhouse gas emissions that are in the atmosphere now, okay, are in the atmosphere now, are due to the United States. 25% historic greenhouse gas concentrations. We're responsible for about 25% of that. Now, we're not responsible for all of it, but we really can't say, well, that doesn't have anything to do with us. And the moral and the ethical dimension works out in a whole bunch of ways. What does the United States do when we're contributing to problems that are being experienced right now in developing countries? What do we do when some of the impacts are being felt in our own country? What do we do when there's a very high level of certainty that a great many property owners, particularly in coastal areas, are going to have their property values and their freedom to use and enjoy the property the way they want to compromised by rising sea levels, stronger storm surges, and all the rest of that? And so what happens then is you take that perspective, a respect for the science and a respect for the moral and ethical and even religious dimension of this, and you say, well, okay, so now what do we do? What do we do at a time of economic downturn? How should we handle this issue? Well, there's one set of options that I think, there's a lot of dumb ways to deal with climate change, and there are smart ways to deal with climate change, just like there are dumb ways to plan your life, and there are smart ways to plan your life. And I think what we need to do is look really hard at what makes sense from the standpoint now of job creation, advancing technology, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, reducing the emission of other air pollutants, and all of the rest of it, making ourselves more secure. In other words, doing those sustainable development things, those sustainable energy things. Well, as it turns out, about 80% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions, actually the number is probably a little higher, come from the burning of fossil fuels. So one, and I was just at a conference in Sacramento a couple of days ago where somebody was running the numbers, and they said, you know, you can get way more out of efficiency and conservation with existing off-the-shelf technologies now than you can get with nuclear power or with wind or with any of the rest of this. So what are the opportunities on the efficiency and conservation side? Well, it turns out, as you can probably guess, that there's no magic bullet. But one thing that's really interesting is that the cap and trade legislation that's in front of Congress now probably won't do the trick on efficiency and conservation by itself. Why? Because as Robert Stavins has pointed out in his analysis and advocacy and so forth for cap and trade really doesn't do a very good job of getting to energy efficiency. The price signals are often sent to the wrong people, like in landlord-tenant situations, for example. And the price signal that you get from trading, probably, even now, there are cost-effective energy efficiency opportunities that people don't take advantage of. Why would that change under cap and trade? So I think putting together a portfolio of measures, whether it's in climate change legislation or whether it's in energy legislation, that really focuses hard on efficiency and conservation is probably a good thing to do. What might those things look like? There's a huge amount of energy savings and greenhouse gas savings and job creation that we could get with a really big program to renovate and upgrade at existing residential and commercial structures. There's a huge amount. Something like 30-40% of U.S. energy consumption comes from existing buildings. That's one place. But then there's some other stuff that's kind of more banal, really, and I'm just going to give you two examples and then one or two more things and I'll wrap up. But the thought here is that if you took traffic lights, you've been in traffic in cities where you wait a minute at a traffic light and then it turns green and you go the next block and it's red again, And then you go another minute, okay, you don't go to the next light, which is two more blocks away, and it's red again. Imagine a world in which the traffic lights were all synchronized. Well, the technical people that have done the modeling say if you had a national effort to synchronize traffic lights, you could get considerable energy savings. And what I'm trying to suggest is there's dozens and dozens of these kinds of opportunities out there. There really are a lot of those choices if we just look for them. My point really is that
no one would have wanted this. No one in this room thinks that the economic situation that we're in is a good one. I've been advocating efficiency and conservation for a long time. But when the question about, well, can we afford climate change is based on the idea that it's going to have to cost more. The premise of sustainable development is that if we invest, not just with the economy in mind, but with the environment in mind, with jobs and with technology and security in mind, we actually get more benefits across the entire dimension of all of those things than if we're not thinking about this stuff at all. And that's really my message here. There's a way to do this. We need to do it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back. Suppose I shouldn't upset the judge and tell him that most of my family went to Penn State, but that's another issue. I want to step back a little bit from talking about what we should do or shouldn't do in the context of climate change to spend a little bit of time talking about what, whether we like it or not, we are committed to doing. That is to say, what under current law at the federal level we have to do if we just sit and watch the climate policy train keep going. Because the reality is whatever we think we should be doing with climate change, however much we think it is or is not a problem, whether we think the goal should be emission reductions, adaptation, geoengineering, or whatever else, legally we are committed to doing a lot. And it's not going to be pretty. And I think that changes the calculus in some important ways in talking about climate change policy and the various climate change policy options that we have. Obviously, the current financial situation changes some of those calculations even more. So what I want to do initially is talk about what we are doing or are going to have to do, like it or not, if there's not legislative change. And then if I have time, I'll say a little bit about some alternatives that we may need to put on the table. The shorthand of what I'm going to tell you is that a lot of the emission reduction policies that are on the table may be a really bad idea. And in fact, I think many of them are. But as unfortunately is so often the case, it's the law. Now, the first place to start is with the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts versus EPA, and I don't think we need to spend a lot of time talking about what happened in that case. Basically, the Supreme Court was forced to answer a handful of questions, the most important being whether or not the Clean Air Act authorizes the regulation of greenhouse gases for motor vehicles. I submitted a brief saying that no, it did not. Further arguing that the plaintiffs should not have standing because even accepting their own scientific estimates, the most that they could, the injury that they complained of and that could be redressed was less than an inch of sea level rise over the next 100 years. But we lost those points. And the Supreme Court concluded that the Clean Air Act, whether it was intended to or not, did authorize the regulation of greenhouse gases. And although the decision itself did not say it, the reality is that the Massachusetts versus EPA decision effectively requires the regulation of greenhouse gases. The standard in the Clean Air Act is that if the administrator could reasonably conclude that the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere could reasonably be anticipated to adversely affect the public health or welfare, then they must be regulated under various provisions. And the reality is the Environmental Protection Agency has for years, under the Bush administration, under the Clinton administration, in official documents and unofficial documents, even in the original Federal Register notice in which it initially denied the authority to regulate greenhouse gases, has effectively said that the accumulation of greenhouse gases can reasonably be anticipated to adversely affect public health and welfare. He didn't use the magic words of an endangerment finding. But the EPA is in a position now of not simply having to make an initial determination about the effect of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. It's actually in the position of having to deny all the things that it has said on top of the things that the National Academy of Sciences said, the IPCC has said, and so on. So even if one believes that the scientific evidence is more equivocal than some, that's not the position the EPA has taken in the Federal Register, in other documents. And given that, I don't think there is any way at this point that the EPA could plausibly argue that the accumulation of greenhouse gases do not satisfy the requirement or satisfy what is necessary for an endangerment finding, and therefore it must regulate. Now, Massachusetts versus EPA only concerned Section 202 of the Act, which deals with new motor vehicles. So that's the first part that we get. And that's what the Bush administration's advance notice of proposed rulemaking that they dropped a few months ago at least initially addressed. This was a something like 500-page document in the Federal Register where the Bush administration basically said, regulating greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act is really crazy. It will make a mess. It will grind administration of this act to a halt. It will impose tremendous costs for minimal benefits. And I think on all those points, the Bush administration was correct. The Bush administration then said, well, what do we do about it? And effectively kicked the can down the road so that the next administration could deal with it. Well, we know what they have to do with it. They have to issue standards under Section 202 for motor vehicles. They have to issue standards under the provisions relating to other types of vehicles, like off-road vehicles, planes, boats, and so on. They have to issue standards for stationary sources, including for example, under the PSD provisions, the prevention of significant deterioration provisions. They probably, absent some really creative reading of the relevant Clean Air Act provisions, have to set national ambient air quality standards under the Clean Air Act. And for those of you that know something about the Clean Air Act, you already know how crazy that is. For those of you that don't, basically the idea is this. Under the Clean Air Act, we set air quality standards that every metropolitan area has to meet. And the idea is that Washington, D.C. has to worry about getting the smog below a certain level, and New York has to do this, and Phoenix, and so on. And that each metropolitan area is doing this essentially on its own or on a regional basis through the state government. And the states have to issue state implementation plans saying how they're going to achieve that. And if they don't, they lose their highway funds, and the federal government will do it for them. And it makes sense when you're talking about localized pollutants. It makes sense when you're talking about the sorts of pollutants that the Clean Air Act was actually written to deal with. It doesn't make sense when you're talking about substances that are globally dispersed. We can't meaningfully talk about greenhouse gas concentrations in Washington, D.C. being meaningfully different than in Boise, Idaho, Los Angeles, California, or Shanghai. But yet that is what the Act requires. And it was, in some respects, a brilliant strategic move that the petitioners in Massachusetts versus EPA, some of whom had filed a parallel suit in federal court to require the setting of a national ambient air quality standard, under the Clean Air Act, took a voluntary dismissal of that case before Mass versus EPA was argued before the Supreme Court, so they could honestly say to the Supreme Court, when presented with this crazy scenario as an argument for why the Clean Air Act didn't apply, they could say, oh, but Your Honor, there is no such case pending. No one is filing a case right now or is pressing the claim that such standards have to be adopted. And at that moment, they were correct. But under the holding of Massachusetts versus EPA and under the Clean Air Act, that is required. In terms of some other practical impacts of this, if you just look at the prevention for significant deterioration provisions of the Clean Air Act, these deal typically what we think of with large industrial facilities. There are somewhere around 200 to 300 such facilities that have to go through PSD permitting right now. And PSD permitting only is imposed on major sources that emit a minimum amount of tons of the relevant pollutant per year. But given that relevant facilities tend to emit carbon dioxide in much greater volume than other pollutants, we will see once it is applied to PSD, and just a couple weeks ago, the Environmental Appeals Board of the EPA remanded a PSD permit for its failure to address carbon dioxide emissions. We will see now not 200 to 300 facilities a year that have to deal with the PSD, or 200 to 300 facilities have to deal with PSD permitting, but 2 to 3,000. So just that one tiny slice of the Clean Air Act, we're going to see a tenfold increase in the permitting requirements. Now, but it's not just the Clean Air Act. I have more good news. Recently, the Fish and Wildlife Service listed the polar bear as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. Now, I will take what may be the unpopular position to think that under, to say that under the law, I think the Fish and Wildlife Service had no choice. The short answer for that, for why that is the Endangered Species Act requires you to use the best available science. And while we know as a near metaphysical certainty, polar bears at prior times, such as the last medieval warm period, somehow managed to survive absent Arctic ice, there were no scientists there to document those findings. There are no studies showing us how they did it. Therefore, we have no science about how they survived. And the only science we have on polar bears and Arctic sea ice seems to suggest quite strongly that less Arctic sea ice is much worse for polar bears. Now, what is this going to do? It's going to do a lot of things, none of which are particularly good for polar bears. Among other things, it will effectively defund the most important conservation for use program for polar bears that exists in the world. But one of the things it will do is it's going to require consultation for the effects of carbon dioxide emissions and greenhouse gas emissions for all significant federal actions are all significant actions that are undertaken, authorized, or funded by the federal government under Section 7 under the ESA. Now, these projects will go through because once the consultation process begins, the judgment of the Fish and Wildlife Service will be, okay, the marginal impact of this project isn't also great. But that's not the standard of the Act. That's not the standard that the courts have applied in terms of the threshold consultation requirement. And as folks at Fish and Wildlife Service will tell you, they do not have the personnel, they do not have the resources to come anywhere close to engaging in all the required consultations that the polar bear listing and the additional listings that are soon coming. There are something like 8 or 10 species that petitions have also, additional petitions have been filed for to require a listing that will essentially be listed for the same reasons as the polar bear. The Fish and Wildlife Service has no ability to do these consultations, but they will be required. The Bush administration is currently working on a rule to try and completely rewrite Section 7 regulations. It's in some respects an admirable effort to try and avoid a true regulatory train wreck. It is an effort that will fail, and it would fail even if the Obama administration was intending to leave these rules when they are finally issued intact. Because I don't think, given the way the courts have interpreted Section 7, these regulatory revisions have a prayer of being upheld. So we have another regulatory train wreck in the offing by doing nothing. So that creates a situation, whether like it or not, the discussion over climate change right now is not do we do something, do we do nothing, it's what do? Because sitting on our hands results in a massive amount of regulation going forward. And I think it's quite clear in the current Congress, and I heard that just this morning, that Henry Waxman will upset John Dingell as chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee. The question is what, given this legislature, could be produced that would be preferable what we're going to see under these acts. Is it a cap-and-trade system like that advocated by John McCain and Barack Obama during the campaign? Is it a carbon tax that a lot of my economist friends think would be preferable, and I will admit I think would be preferable to a cap-and-trade system? Is it something else? And if we implemented it, would we ever let it be actually be enforced? Now, I'm pretty sure that I'm about out of time. So let me just say one last thing. I think as some of the data that Steve shared with us earlier shows, we have no clue how to reduce emissions to the level that would, in the words of the IPCC, avoid dangerous levels of what they consider dangerous levels of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. We have no clue how to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions in the near to medium term. The sorts of technologies that are required are things that aren't even yet dreamt of. Even if we did everything that John suggested, we don't come close to Obama's targets, let alone the targets that would be actually necessary to stabilize concentrations, the levels talked about. And then on top of that, in our current economic situation, it's not as if the federal government's going to start writing lots of checks to subsidize lots of new R&D in this area. And I would say even if they did, it's not as if that sort of R&D would produce much. We've been spending billions of dollars on R&D and for alternative energy sources over the last 50 years and have precious little to show for it, particularly if we're interested in commercially viable technologies. But there are some sorts of other things we should look at. I'm just going to mention one and then turn the mic over to Jeremy. It was actually, in my view, probably the only good idea on energy policy we heard from either major candidate during the campaign. And so as a consequence, it was mentioned once in a speech, put at the very end of a list of talking points, and then never heard from again. And what that idea was idea of a prize for innovation. Say instead of picking out labs and picking winners and losers and throwing subsidies at people, we're going to say instead, you know, there are innovations, there are ideas, there are solutions we really, really need, and we have no clue how to get there. But we figure if we hold out the possibility of a big enough reward that maybe somebody out there, somebody who's not already in a federal lab, somebody who's not already at the federal trough, might actually be able to do it. When the British Empire wanted to improve navigation, this is what they did. And the guy that won the prize was someone that never would have gotten a grant from the Crown because his ideas were seen as so ludicrous before he proved them. The virtues of prizes are many. I'm just going to mention a couple. The first is you don't spend the money until you actually have something in return, something that federal subsidy programs typically can't claim. The second is you are spurring more innovation than you're actually spending. When some private entrepreneurs underwrote the Ansari X Prize for feasible manned low-orbit space travel, they offered a $10 million prize and spurred over $100 million in private investment that produced all sorts of entrepreneurial innovation that we would not have seen otherwise. Prizes aren't subject to the same sort of rent-seeking and special interest money-grubbing that we typically see in the subsidy process, which is certainly another benefit. And it's also a benefit, another benefit is it's something that we see in operation all the time, because the principle behind using prizes is the same principle that underlies our patent system. The idea that sometimes, for whatever reason, we don't think the market by itself is going to produce the type of innovation we want, so we will offer to people a super competitive reward for achieving something. That's what a patent effectively does, giving an innovator monopoly rents for a particular period of time. A prize can do the same thing. So if it were up to me and I was trying to come up with one big idea, something to do, while we try and avoid all the crazy things that we're in the process of doing now, I would say, why don't we take the present value of all the energy R&D we're planning on spending in the next 10 years and divvy it up into a handful of prizes for a handful of innovations that we really need, things that are transformative. And maybe that would help us figure out how to do some of these things in a less costly and a less ridiculous way. Thank you.
Can't see the front of this podium, does it?
Do you have a flag?
No? It's just a naked podium? Well, sometimes the Federalist Society puts up this banner, which gives you the full name. If it's a big banner, they can fit the full name. It's actually the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy. And I believe all the previous speakers wanted to talk about public policy. Someone here should talk about law. Or let's put it another way. They give you those ties, and they have James Madison. Someone here should talk about something that James Madison would recognize. I think he'd be stupefied that the other people want to talk about how to change the Earth's climate, which is a little beyond, I think, the ambitions of our founders. Before I get to this, though, I do want to say, I want to talk about constitutional problems with likely approaches. But just in the interest of full disclosure, I want to say I totally agree with Steve Hayward. There's no way anything we do is going to actually make a difference to the Earth's climate. It is not possible for the United States on its own or the United States in Europe on their own to hold their breath long enough to change whatever trends are happening in the atmosphere. In order to do that, we'd have to get China to hold its breath, and India to hold its breath, and the rest of the third world to hold their breath. That's not going to happen. But I disagree with Steve's point that since it's impossible, it won't be attempted. That's not how the world works. I'm old enough to remember conferences that I went to back in the 1980s when people were explaining that the EU was impossible, or European integration was impossible. And every successive treaty, they said, this one will never go through because it's impossible. And finally, they got to be treaties that were rejected, but it didn't matter. They went forward anyway because when a bad idea, you know, reaches its hour, the clock keeps moving and the bad idea rolls forward. So I think it's almost certain that some ambitious new things will be attempted, and I just want to focus you briefly on some constitutional challenges which they will present to us. I say one other thing just by way of introduction to this, which is I think people will be particularly insistent in the next few years on having a treaty which links the responses of different countries to each other, which not only would be logical, but I think people will insist on it now because we are likely to have serious economic problems over the next few years, which makes everybody irritable. I mean, all governments irritable and worried that some other country is reaping advantage by interpreting some international mandate in a way that is helpful to it but harmful to its rivals. So people, I think, will be more insistent than they would have been otherwise on we all have to hold hands as we go forward. If you look at Kyoto, which I think there'll be efforts to improve on Kyoto, but if you just look at Kyoto, it had three ideas which weren't very well developed and never got very well developed, but three things that were part of the package so that it wouldn't just be holding your breath or sucking in your carbon dioxide. And one was a suggestion about trade in emission rights. You could buy the right to emit more carbon dioxide from somebody else who wasn't using their capacity to emit carbon dioxide. That's a very complicated thing to do. Cap-and-trade programs are rather elaborate, require a whole lot of legal infrastructure. So the question is, how would that work across national boundaries? One other thing in Kyoto was you could, as a country, give yourself more emission rights by, or you could satisfy some of your reduction by arranging for reductions in other countries, in less developed countries, where they could reduce their rate of emission increase with new technology which you could provide. And that's another complicated thing. How would you count it? How would you measure it? How would you assure that there's not cheating, not fraud in this? And finally, there's a reference to reducing your emission obligations by planting trees and doing other things to soak up carbon dioxide, to have carbon sinks. But mostly they're thinking about planting trees. Same kind of issues. How much credit should you get for how many acres of planting? Does it matter in what latitude you are? Actually, it does matter in real life. Trees soak up more in some places than others. They have longer growing seasons in some places than others. How is all this to be calculated and credited? All of this implies that there have to be a lot of elaborations, refinements, in effect regulatory add-ons to the basic treaty. We didn't get very far in this in Kyoto. If we go forward with a post-Kyoto treaty and the United States is participating, which I think is more likely than not, that there will be a post-Kyoto treaty, that the United States will be participating, you're talking about a whole lot of international regulatory infrastructure on a scale that is totally beyond anything we've ever seen before. And this will present constitutional problems. The one that I want to focus you on is you have the treaty. The treaty's ratified by the Senate. And then there's all these regulatory add-ons. There are these elaborations. What is their status? We have a little prefiguring of this. The Montreal Protocol on ozone-depleting substances, exactly this, and it's a much, much more modest thing because you're not focused on energy use but just on a small number of specialized chemicals. But they kept changing their assessment of how much reduction was necessary in the emission of chlorofluorocarbons, thank you, CFCs, and methyl bromide and other substances. They kept changing the calculations and how quickly it had to be phased out. And what they did was they had a conference of the parties to the Montreal Protocol, and they'd have a meeting somewhere, and they would vote, let's do this. The treaty authorized, going back to the Vienna Convention that launched this all, additions by two-thirds vote of the parties, recalibrations by two-thirds vote of the parties. There was a case that came to the D.C. Court of Appeals in 2005 called Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, versus the EPA. The NRDC said the EPA had not acted to implement the latest ratchet that had been agreed by parties to the Montreal Protocol. The D.C. Court of Appeals said we just cannot believe that Congress really meant to have the EPA act directly on the basis of a vote taken at an international gathering. They went a little further than that. They said, well, it's possible that Congress actually did mean this because Congress actually did sort of indicate this in amendments to the Clean Air Act. But they said, it seems to us there would be really serious constitutional problems. Either this would mean that you are allowing a bunch of foreign governments to amend an American treaty, because a two-thirds vote would then be binding on the EPA without even the president necessarily approving. We could have been in the one-third. We happen not to be, but we could have been, let alone the Senate. So it's either delegating the treaty power to some foreign gathering, some international gathering, or what might be even worse, it is delegating American legislative authority to some international gathering. And the D.C. Court of Appeals said, these issues are too momentous. There's no Supreme Court opinion that says clearly you can or you can't, but we just don't quite think this could be acceptable. They mention there has been litigation, that is 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, the D.C. Court of Appeals says there's been litigation about the death penalty and whether decisions by the International Court of Justice should be binding on American courts. And they say, well, the Supreme Court had one go-round on this and they decided not to pursue the case, but there were six different opinions. The Supreme Court is incredibly fragmented. Well, last spring, the Supreme Court in Medellin versus Texas actually did address this. And as you recall, the majority of the Supreme Court said the decision of the International Court of Justice is not binding on U.S. courts. It's something that takes place at the level of international law, but not something that immediately enters into our law at home. What's particularly interesting about that case is six justices held to this view. Three said, no, let's go. It should go directly into American law because it can, and that'd be good for us, and let's do it. But the six did not say it couldn't. They just said, looking at the Senate resolution of ratification and looking at the usual American practice, we don't think it's clear that the Senate had agreed to, in this particular treaty scheme involving consular relations, make appeals to the International Court of Justice binding in American domestic law. What I take that to mean is the following. Six justices willing to say, not yet. There are not six, maybe there's not five to say never. If you add that to the D.C. Court of Appeals decision in NRDC versus EPA, I think what that says is we're open to having a fight, which it is not clear how the Supreme Court would settle this. But I think it is something really on the horizon in the next few years that we'll have rather elaborate international regulatory structure. We will have a lot of interests within the United States whose be a lot of money at stake, whether you can count it this way or count it that way. People will want to invoke international standards made by some kind of international conference, and American courts will be not quite certain whether this goes directly into American law or whether the Senate has to have a say or some majority in the House and the Senate for a legislative executive agreement, or at least the president needs to have a direct say. All that will present very, very interesting issues. The reason why I think those issues will be of more than, let's say, technical interest or scholarly interest. This is at present one of the fundamental differences between the United States and its approach to international law and countries of the European Union. European countries do actually accept that regulations can be made for them by a bureaucracy in Brussels, and they will be binding on their governments, enforceable by their courts. A couple of years ago, there was a survey by The Economist magazine. They asked governments in different countries in Europe, how much of the law that you're enforcing is made by bureaucrats in Brussels? And they got different answers, but it was around half. A number of places, government officials said it's more than half. So this is a very big change in how these countries are governed. If you are really talking about regulating use of energy across the whole economy, you are talking potentially about regulation with huge economic impact, huge political implications, and you're talking about moving this from Washington to some international center somewhere. That is a very, very big change. Some people say this could not happen because it's just too fantastical. I will close with another authority often invoked at Federalist Society gatherings, someone even more authoritative than James Madison, that is the philosopher Aristotle, who said, "What has happened can happen." Thank you.
Thank you. We've got some time for questions. As the moderator, I'd like to exercise the prerogative to start with the first one, and I hope we'll get some questions on law, but I did want to start with one on policy. John, I was going to ask you to respond initially, and perhaps one or two others might have an answer. Most elected officials that I'm familiar with, whether they're governors or presidents, seem to care about economic growth, unemployment rates, and the like, and my question is the extent to which these responses to climate change realistically can deal with those political ambitions. When I think of all the news coverage recently about the plight of the American car companies, Americans buying fewer cars, holding onto these cars for a longer period of time, factories having to be closed down, companies maybe going to Chapter 11, perhaps even Chapter 13, I've yet to see anybody say, well, perhaps this would all be good for the environment, as it probably would be. But I don't think any elected official would ever say that. So, I mean, John, you talked about conservation, and clearly that's important. I mean, one great form of conservation, of course, is a 10-year recession. That will decrease, a lot of these emissions and other problems, but that can't be politically the answer. So what does an elected official do to deal with these concerns in a realistic way?
It's a really good question, and obviously it's really timely. I'm going to give you a perspective from the state level where, as the judge indicated, I've spent about half my career. Basically, the energy issue in Pennsylvania in the last 6 years has been cast not really as a climate change issue. It's been cast as a job creation issue, as about fostering the development of new technology. It's about making Pennsylvania a center for energy innovation for part of the next century. And an easy example of that, actually probably the best example of that, is our former secretary and our current governor went to Spain and convinced a Spanish wind turbine manufacturer, Gamesa, to locate its North American manufacturing headquarters in Pennsylvania. Now, this, folks, is good old-fashioned economic development. It's all the standard tools that states have been using forever to attract industries to their state. And we have now something like 4,000 manufacturing jobs. A lot of steel workers in the Pittsburgh area are now making wind turbines. And what has been interesting to me at the state level is the extent to which this issue has been cast as one that's about job creation, technology, reducing other pollution, making the state attractive in a lot of other ways, and, oh, by the way, addressing climate change. That's the way it's been addressed at the state level. And I was not in Ann Arbor more than 6 weeks ago listening to Governor Granholm express the same aspiration for Michigan and to using the car manufacturers as an example of that. She's doing the same thing that Governor Rendell is. I've heard the same thing from a whole bunch of other governors. And so I think there's a way to talk about this that is actually different from
and it's bottom-up stuff. It's coming from the states that is different from the conversation that we've often had in, at the national level.
Two things. One, I think what John alludes to, I think, is an important thing to recognize about what we're seeing at the state level, which is, with the exception of California, state climate policies generally fit into one of two categories. One is the purely symbolic, that is, you know, aspirations, creating cabinet-level committees and so on, but nothing that actually pinches in an economically meaningful way. Or policies that can, at the right time, be characterized as climate policies, but are really about something else. You know, they are some other sorts of policies that are given kind of this green gloss. And as for those, the policies that fit in that second category, whether or not one finds the argument that state-driven environmental investment is going to create jobs and produce all these other benefits really is a question of whether or not one believes that state-driven industrial policy as a general matter is an effective way of increasing growth, increasing wages, increasing jobs, and so on. I happen to be one that thinks it's not. I happen to think you get the broken window fallacy, and you certainly see the winners of when you get a new plant sited, but overall the economies of the states that spend all of their time trying to pick winners and losers don't end up doing better. And I think that the economic literature is pretty robust on that point. And it's not an environmental, non-environmental thing. It's just a question of state governments, like all governments, aren't particularly good at using industrial policy as a way of promoting economic development.
Can I make a quick observation, Judge? Yeah. Just as a historical matter, I went once and looked quite carefully at the energy consumption data from the Great Depression, because you mentioned that one way to reduce conserve is to have a depression. Of course, consumption went way down of energy and everything else. Energy efficiency went in reverse for common sense reasons if you think about it for 10 seconds. And it's not clear to me if today we're that much smarter that we can reverse the overall phenomenon that represents of diminished capital expenditures, people not trading up for better boilers in industrial settings or in their, you know, home appliances.
Go here, then we'll go, you're next, and then we'll continue back here.
I'm Kai Alberg. Where I live in Western Washington, in a few years, two dams will be removed pursuant to federal legislation to restore salmon runs and protect the endangered salmon. This will cause about an additional 70,000 tons a year of CO2 to be emitted by other power plants that will pick up the slack. I understand in Oregon there's a much bigger effort to deny repermitting for some dams that are currently producing power for about 700,000 consumers. Eventually, I would expect this conflict between endangered species legislation taking out clean power hydro dams and the Clean Air Act and the pursuit of reducing CO2 emissions will wind up in front of a court somewhere. I'd like to ask the panelists how they think a judge will or ought to analyze those issues when they come in front of a court.
Jonathan, you seem to be.
I would say they should follow the law, which in many cases means doing things that with these statutes that don't make a lot of sense. I mean, right now there's nothing in the Clean Air Act that would preclude the removal of these dams. And if they are legally required based on other agreements that have been made, then they're going to go forward with that. But I would note this conflict between different environmental values in the context of energy aren't new to climate change. And hydro, we see them in a quite pointed way, but we see them with all sorts of alternative energy sources, because the reality is there is no source of energy that is free of environmental impacts. And it turns out that those that happen to be less carbon intensive have other impacts. With hydro, it's affecting rivers and streams. With wind power, it's certainly with older types of wind turbines, there's the problem of bird kills. With newer ones, it's the problem of, in the words of RFK Jr., despoiling the water wilderness off the coast of Massachusetts should wind farms be built. But, you know, there are these trade-offs, and our existing legal structure makes it very difficult to actually deal with those trade-offs in a reasonable way. So, for example, with the Cape Wind Project and other offshore wind development proposals, the permitting process creates lots of opportunities to simply throw up roadblocks and prevent any development at all, but doesn't create really any opportunity for an agency, let alone the public, to engage in any sort of discussion about what sort of trade-offs we are or are not willing to make to meet one set of environmental goals versus another. And that's just one of the pathologies that our existing environmental laws have given us.
We've got a question over here.
Yes, thank you. My name is Buddy Menton from the New York chapter. I think there's on the order of 5 billion people in the world now who are outside essentially the energy economy, don't have electricity, don't have cars, don't have home heat, etc. They haven't caught up with the level of standard of living that we have. And the question I have is, are those people to be allowed to join our standard of living, or are they to be locked into poverty forever? I think that if we could double the energy efficiency of the United States, we couldn't come near to the energy saving that would be necessary to bring those people up to our standard of living, even if they had double the efficiency that we have. So how's this to be done? And isn't that really a more important moral issue than saving the coastal property of a Hamptons millionaire?
Well, John, I know John has written a little bit about this. So,
I think the reality is if we don't do anything about greenhouse gas emissions in the United States or anywhere else, we're going to continue to drive those people even further into poverty. That's the short answer. That's the truth. Now, there's more.
Do you have a basis for saying
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I actually do, because what happens here is climate change, and there's a ton of science on this, is adversely affecting already and will continue to adversely affect the people who have the least ability to adapt. We can buy air conditioners and all the rest of that, but in a lot of other places, you can't do that. And there's a lot of other parts of the world right now that are already actually quite worried about this or already experiencing those impacts. And what all the science says, I mean, the IPCC reports all say, is you continue to push greenhouse gas emissions up, you get higher and higher levels of greenhouse gas concentrations all around the world, and the people who are going to be most adversely affected by that are the poor. And that's a starting point. Now, the second thing, though, and this is alluded to by some of the other speakers, that I think is terribly important, is trying to figure out how we get from here to there. And I know everybody's talked about that problem, everybody. And what the federal climate bills pretty much all say is let's get from here to there in about, I don't know, 40 years, by 2050, 40-some years. And I think there's kind of an interesting question about projects like that. If you know what the first group of things that you really need to do are, but you don't know what to do after that, do you start now anyway with the expectation that in 5 or 10 years you'll have a little better idea of what the next steps ought to be? Or do you say, well, we don't know what the end point is now. We don't know how to get there from here to 2050. We don't know how to do that, so we're not going to start. And I prefer the first approach for a couple of different reasons. One is we've done it before. We did it when we declared war on Germany and Japan. We did it when we said we'd send a man to the moon by the end of the 1960s. This is America, right? We do things that are important to do, knowing in advance that there is a risk we might fail, but knowing that this is something that is worth doing. And it's worth doing, by the way, as I pointed out before, for its own sake. I mean, not just because of climate change. There's a bunch of other benefits we get from this. And I agree with you completely. I don't think you get there by doubling energy efficiency. I think you get there by increasing the efficiency with which we use energy by one or two orders of magnitude. And I think that's doable. It's doable if we put our minds to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One, I think the flip side of what John said that we have to think about is that so much of our energy use is a function of capital stock and infrastructure and things that we don't buy on a yearly or even decade, buy every decade. So if we rush to do our first little step now, we may be locking in certain types of capital stock for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. And in many cases, waiting will actually be, it'll be that much easier and that much cheaper to produce greater reductions later. We've seen in a whole bunch of areas, certainly in the telecom area, that when something comes along that is that much cheaper and that much more efficient, the market doesn't need a lot of help to change over very, very quickly. The key is to have that innovation that actually is the leap forward as opposed to the tiny step forward. On the other point, just a quick little thought experiment. Assume, and I think John's right on this, that the most likely effects of climate change are far worse on tropical parts of the world than temperate parts of the world, far worse on poorer, less developed nations than the United States. For those that are interested, AEI did a monograph several years ago by Robert Mendelson from Yale. I think it's called something like The Greening of Global Warming or The Greening of Climate Change that summarizes the economic and climate literature on this, and the basic bottom line answers aren't really any different. That under any reasonable scenario, countries like Bangladesh lose. So then the question is, if they had the choice, would they rather us figure out how to reduce our emissions when a lot of the effects that we're talking about are locked into the system and are unavoidable and are mixed in with things that are going on in the world anyway? Or would they rather us indemnify them, compensate them, you know, help them be more like the Dutch and build dikes so they don't have to worry about flooding and so on? I don't think there's any question what they would choose. And I don't think there's any question what is orders of magnitude cheaper over the next, say, 30 to 50 years. So if our concern is a moral one, and I think John's correct to raise that issue, I've written a paper saying that a lot of folks on the right haven't given this part of climate change enough thought, the answer is probably not short to medium term efforts to reduce emissions, because that's not going to enhance welfare in developing nations. And it's going to be less efficient, and it's not what they would have wanted if we'd given them the choice.
Okay, next question.
Tupi from Pittsburgh. Judge Sutton, you mentioned the Buckeyes. You left out the Cincinnati Bengals, didn't you?
That's pretty easy to do.
The reason I came forward was I was disappointed that no one on the panel challenged the premise of man-made global warming. There are thousands of scientists who do. The notion of consensus, Mr. Dernbach, I think flies in the face of that. Thousands of scientists have signed petitions suggesting that they dispute the notion. And personally, the notion that a natural chemical substance that makes up only 370 parts per million of our atmosphere gives us control over climate is preposterous. Thank you.
The first stab at that?
Sure. Sure.
Look, I disagree with John to this extent. I think there is a robust argument over how much. I mean, the basic theory that greenhouse gases trap heat, that is a pretty sound theory. But the question is it 1 degree or 4 degrees? I think I can use citations from the IPCC reports on this. However, I've reached a state of repose about this. As badly politicized as science is, it is an iterative process. And with past problems that we have overestimated, not problems that were wrong, but that we misestimated or overestimated, I think that if the skeptical case is right, that is going to be borne out in the fullness of time. And so I'm perfectly happy to wait and sit back and let that process take its way. And by the way, successive iterations of the IPCC, if they get better at it, then they will be borne out by the evidence. I mean, the one thing that seems a problem for me right now, socially, you might say, is that global temperatures have been flat for the last 7-8 years, and this year is going to come in about the coldest year in 30 years. I guarantee the New York Times headline in January will say, coldest year in 30 years, but we're all still doomed. Now, it may be perfectly consistent with the catastrophic case. Some of the European modelers have said it's ocean currents, it's temporary. But when, like Al Gore, you have made the arrival of the 2-day early arrival of every cock robin in the spring a harbinger of imminent catastrophe, and suddenly you get a few cold years, that causes them a big problem. And I think you're going to see that play out in the next 3-4 years, is my sort of 50% probability guess about the matter.
Okay. Go ahead. Just a couple of quick things on that. A lot of the scientists that have been weighing in on the other side are actually not climate scientists. And that's a serious concern. Now the other part of it though is if you go to, you go to 5 doctors, and 4 of them tell you you've got a problem, and 1 of them doesn't. What do you do with that? Do you decide who you're going to listen to and walk away, or do you do something prudent? And the argument that I'm making is that this is not about black and white. This is not like whether there's a tooth fairy or whether there's Santa Claus. What we're doing here is we're taking a – where you can just kind of believe it or not, and it really doesn't matter. What we're doing for real is we're putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and we are for real creating serious risks of both short- and long-term problems, some of which are now being borne out. Now, I'm a career environmental law guy, part of my experience is that there's a question about what the risk is, and you try to assess that, and then there's a risk management question. And the risk management question is, what does a prudent society do in the face of abundant evidence
What do you do? And I don't think that's a question that you can simply say sort of yes or no to. I mean, part of my life experience is as a problem solver, and I think as a problem solver, you look for prudent, appropriate things to do. There's some other things I could say, but that's probably enough for now.
Thanks.
I actually agree with both John and Steve on this point, and let me say why. If you look at the people that are held up as skeptics, and in a recent paper I did this, I used only sources that would be characterized as skeptical. You know, so Pat Michaels, Roy Spencer, Bob Bowling, and so on. Do you find them claiming that human activity has no effect on the climate? No, you do not. Do you find them saying that existing and projected emissions of greenhouse gases will not affect temperature and will not warm the earth, all else equal? No, you do not. Do you find them saying there will be no sea level rise? No, you do not. You find them saying that the changes in climate will be much less than, say, as Stephen Schneider says or Jim Hansen says. You find them saying that the effect on sea level will be much less and much closer to the background noise, but you don't see them saying zero. Dick Lindzen at MIT, who in terms of his estimate of the climate responsiveness of the atmosphere is at the low end of people that are really actively involved, still doesn't say zero. So you don't have the people that are skeptics aren't skeptical with underlying mechanisms. They're skeptical about whether or not the world's going to end. But the other point is that the debate really isn't over whether or not the world's going to end. The debate is over whether or not if we believe and have good reason to believe that certain effects are going to happen, what do or don't we do about them? And I think that is a policy debate that we have given uncertainty, because we have uncertainty in every heavily science-dependent question. And then secondly, we also have to stop pretending, and this isn't a right or left thing. This is a pathology that is endemic to environmental policy generally and is in some cases written into our laws. We have to stop pretending that answering the scientific question with a particular level of certainty answers the policy question, because the policy question is always a normative question and the science question is a positive question. And the scientific answering the scientific question will inform our normative judgment, but it cannot and should not ever dictate it. And too often in this debate and other debates, we pretend as if, oh, once we get the science right, we know the answer. Well, no, we don't. We just have a different baseline for our debate.
Let me just give an illustration of that.
You had to enter the policy debate. We tried.
But at least I'll change the subject. everyone is saying who wants to do something dramatic about global warming that 50 years or 80 years or 100 years from now, it could be really, really hard on Bangladesh, which, you know, I'm sorry for Bangladesh, but 80 or 100 years is a fairly long planning horizon. What's it going to be for countries near Iran when they get nuclear weapons next year or the year after? I think worse consequences than flooding, even. And this is something we've been living with since 1945. People said after Hiroshima, this is so scary, this is beyond anything we've ever experienced, which it was. And so people said, it's obvious that we need world government to deal with it, because only world government can deal with the challenge of nuclear war, which is so terrible that it's worth any risk. Well, actually, no. It turned out no government in the world was prepared to say that. Except for Luxembourg, which just had to be satisfied with the EU. The fact that you hold up to us something which is a frightening possibility doesn't mean that we suspend all judgment, go into a swoon, and say, that's so scary that we're putting you in charge of the world. Take it from here. And I do think that is really what's being said when people say, let's start on this process which will, in the next 3 decades, have us not just cut our energy use by half, but by orders of magnitude. Let's look forward to a day within a period in which the young members of the Federal Society will still be with us, in which they will be using one-tenth as much energy as today. And you really have to say, are you serious? Are you serious? And if you are serious about America, which is, after all, a rich country, probably we have 10 times more than we need. That was an excellent question about the Third World. I mean, China is not going to do this, period. This is not hypothetical. I mean, they said at Kyoto, our answer is the three no's. No, we will not do it now. No, we will not do it later. No, we will not do it ever. And so what we're really talking about is, let's have a confrontation with China over this, because the fate of the Earth is at stake. And since the fate of the Earth is at stake, it's really worthwhile having a confrontation with nuclear China over forcing them to remain at a very low level of development. And I say, wait a minute, what about Iran is getting the bomb next year? Couldn't we handle that one first? No, that's just a passing problem. That's just like a minor thing right now. I mean, people choose the horror that they like to focus on, but my taste is let's focus on manageable things that are near at hand rather than remote things which we really have no, with present technology and present prospects, any way of dealing with it.
The panel's almost over, and we've got one more questioner, so I want to let you have your question. But see if you can make it a one-sentence question with just a few clauses.
Wow. Okay, put me right off my game. Stephen, James Hansen has the answer for cold years. That's to use September's data for October. And on both the state and federal action questions, you both had interesting points, but I'm thinking on the federal level, you talked about the clash between the Clean Air Act and the Endangered Species Act. What happens when, in essence, a self-appointed trustee for the polar bear attacks the self-appointed trustee for the salmon? That is a kind of maybe a more interesting question.
John, you're going to give a two-sentence answer with three clauses.
Yeah, the short answer is that the effect of what's going on under the ESA is not going to be to force anybody to do anything other than to force the agency to spend a lot of time and energy and resources that it doesn't have studying something to just effectively grind things to a halt. So whatever the status quo is will be preserved.
All right. Thank you so much for coming. Let's give a hand for our speakers.